I've known Elizabeth for some time, and Joe Subiondo, her partner, who heads the California Institute of Integral Studies. And I've seen how over the last decade that institute has grown and expanded and widened its horizons, kamkakule, and been in touch with Orwell very closely. I happened to meet Elizabeth this summer in San Francisco, and she said that she was planning to come here for a sabbatical, for a resident period of residence. And we had spoken about having a kind of an exchange, an interchange on the divine feminine, how around the world we see the divine feminine, perhaps from different perspectives of a prism, and yet somewhere the convergence is there. She has braved the trauma of the cyclone and come here and stayed here. And we had to postpone this evening with her by a week, but I'm happy we are able to meet before she leaves in a few days' time. If I may do so, I'd like to read out just about a dozen lines of a little poem which is entitled The Eternal She. And that perhaps gives a perspective under which a lot gets covered. So if you'd allow me, I'd just read that, and then Elizabeth would lead the evening for us.
Astor, in the spirit of acknowledging the women and the authors of the great acknowledgement of feminine divinity and feminine things, if you could share with us the poem. Astor, this is a poem you have created, yes?
Yes.
So that you know this.
The eternal she,
beyond name and form, who comes to us in each form of thee. He stands behind with the force of his sanction to all she is and does. Without him, I exist not. Without me, he is unmanifest. To their presence on earth, we are beholden. We who belong to these moments of time, when time itself is overstepping its limits into new horizons of the future.
Well, I'm Elizabeth Ersik. I'm a professor of world religions, and it's something that I came to not in my 20s, not when I first started my college career, but later. And in discussions on how I became interested in this subject and became able to actually teach and research this subject, it very much started with a personal journey. And in speaking with Astor, I found myself speaking about one moment in particular. And so for today, what I'd like to do is to share something that happened to me, something that motivated me to be interested in this, share a little bit of the research that then came out of that interest, and then leave space, even though we don't have much time, but leave some space for you to reflect on when this might have happened or in what way it's happened to you, and have some conversation. So that's what we have planned for today. I went to college and majored in business. I think like many young people in India, the idea of going and contributing to the emergence and very real business and computer success was a piece of what I was called into at my time. But there was something that was not as satisfying as I had expected. And I look around the room and I imagine that every one of you, from the beginning of the college journey to the ones who chose not to go to college, to the ones that started a career in some area and then found this, probably have a story of how that change happened. Well, for me, I was doing my last management consulting project in an area called Arizona, where the Grand Canyon is in the United States. And I was working in Phoenix and then going to Sedona on the weekends. And this one day, I felt pushed beyond what I ethically felt comfortable doing. But it was something that my company had asked me to do. And it broke my heart. When I arrived in Sedona, I was being embraced by some new friends and new ways of thinking. And over the course of that weekend, I had a meditative experience of myself as not myself, as myself outside of myself, seeing myself. But it was the voice, this voice that almost felt like from the center of the universe was a very feminine voice. And I've thought about it in the past couple days, and maybe we all have a voice that plays in our head. And if that voice changes, if it changes how it sounds, if it changes how it speaks to us, we might pay a little more attention. And I did. Somehow this feminine voice, in just one sentence, with almost no words, but just an embrace and actually humor, a little bit of laughter about how I keep repeating things. That Monday, I walked into my office and quit. That gave me the courage to know that there was something. So I spent 5 years in Sedona, and during that time, the music that you heard was a CD that I recorded while I was there. I'd probably left my music for a good 10 years. And sometimes in this journey through kind of what we call feminine things, it's this artistic, it's this movement, it's this sound, it's this beauty, and we almost need to rehydrate ourselves. At least in America, we do. And I found myself having to do that. And the album, I felt myself coming back. Something I had never expected was that album gave me a full fellowship to the Yale Institute of Sacred Music at Yale Divinity School. And I found myself not ever thinking I would do this, but back in study and to work on a Master's of Divinity when I had no background in the subject. And I think with those of you at Oroville, you know what it's like to leap over things and find yourself in new situations with an ability that you didn't know you had. Once I completed that, I received a position as a world religions professor at one of the largest community colleges in the United States. I'm back in Arizona. For 8 years, I've been at Mesa Community College. In addition to teaching world religions, I teach women in religion. While I've been doing that, I've also pursued a PhD. And that subject was in mostly women in religion, as well as the art of what we outpicture when we think of things divine. And I'm particularly interested on when a female image or a feminine feeling comes as a way to communicate with us. In the United States, as Astor was sharing about this perspective from India with this deep tradition of Shakti and goddesses, for many of us raised Christian in the United States, there weren't those images, there wasn't that understanding. And I would even say there was a leftover of Victorian period where the feminine was considered to be pure and passive, maybe held the qualities of beauty and upliftment and wisdom, but not being respected with a certain equality. So what I found was that in the Christian tradition, my experience happened outside of Christianity, but for many, this awakening, and Christianity is the main imprint for many in the United States, it's not the only, but it certainly has a huge cultural imprint on the country, that women and men in their own ways were looking to express some kind of truth, that divinity can be expressed with female images as much as male. So my PhD research was in the character of Sophia. If you look, the first 8 chapters in the book of Proverbs in the Old Testament, She's standing at the gates. She's instructing the people. Her worth is more than silver and gold, and kings and princes seek her counsel. She's a tree. She is she does hospitality. She brings people to the table. And over subsequent chapters in the Bible, she becomes more and more divine. Her last entry, from what we can see, is about 100 years before the birth of Jesus. And she is wisdom incarnate. In fact, when the gospel writers later were trying to convince people that Jesus was in fact divine, making the claim wisdom incarnate was the strongest claim they could make, connecting Jesus actually to the incarnated Sophia. For that reason, and that has given many Christian groups now permission to use this as an expression of God. And so I found three different Christian communities that did this. And I was interested to find out why they did it and how this, as you can imagine, creating great resistance, it's not all that common, how it was handled and why they felt so motivated to do it. I know I was motivated to quit my job, but here these people are motivated to actually change their sacred stage. So the first one, so I'm going to tell you about three. The first one was a Methodist minister. She was one of the first to be ordained in the first wave of United Methodism. This was along with the women's movement in America. And she found herself feeling constrained because she wasn't being respected the way the male priests were. And so she formed this group and they studied the Sophia scriptures. And they went through an Easter weekend, which is the holiest time for Christians, and they did it with Sophia being captured, with Sophia having epithets said and things badly at her, with Sophia being lashed, with Sophia being crucified. And then each woman spoke about how this related to her life. And almost to a person, it had to do with domestic violence. It had to do with rape. It had to do with being called, you're just a woman. Very powerful. If I was to say the difference, Astor at this time was studying at her PhD in the Sorbonne, and we had a conversation about this, and she said, I didn't understand these feminists. They just, this equality, just like a man. And I reflected on that, Astor, and I think for those of us in the West, we never had the deep honoring the way the Shakti is honored here. And so what I learned from this group was that there was this time where equality of all attributes of personhood in a woman made was what was motivating. That was the first group, and that's why they wanted female images. They wanted the female story told, and they wanted the female voice as strong and as seen as the man's. The next group was a group of Catholic nuns. They are called the Daughters of Wisdom. They still exist. They're a worldwide order recognized by the Vatican. Wisdom being wisdom, Sophia, from the Old Testament. In the 1960s, all the Catholic orders were asked to go and find the roots of they call this the Catholic charism, the charism of their order. And so all of a sudden, they found themselves reading the Bible, learning for themselves without being interpreted by a priest, which is how it had been in their education in the 50s, and they found this rich tradition. Today, the Daughters of Wisdom, they teach about Sophia. Now, they had a different take, maybe more Astor-like when we spoke about the complementarity, the feminine, the masculine, together, different, but together and equal. I think for the Catholic nuns, in research terms, we call this homosocial environments, meaning single sex, where if you live in a social environment where gender very much demarcates who can go where and where the sexes should be separated. These women live, even today, in a highly homosocial environment. So you would see that if, and in that environment, the women still are not allowed to be priests, and so finding this voice. Now, unlike the Methodist priest, who really wanted, because she had the position, she wanted the acknowledgement. These sisters have found a way to describe how, from their position in the church, their voices need to be heard. And so they use the Catholic understanding of equal but separate, which is what the church teaches about gender between men and women. But they said that it is the feminine perspective and the feminine voice that is missing that has led to, as we have seen in a lot of newspapers, a lot of misdirected, misaligned energies in that institution, that religious institution. So they think actually the feminine voice is what can save the Catholic Church. Now the last group is very interesting. They are a group of Lutherans from San Francisco. In America, San Francisco is leading edge for many things. This is also where the school is located that Astor, the California Institute of Integral Studies. In the 1960s, they were part of, San Francisco was part of the sexual revolution, the religious spiritual revolution, the all kinds of revolutions. And today, it still is very leading edge for thought, and very much in terms of gender. So what happened was there was an aging Swedish parish, Swedish Lutheran parish, most of them were Swedish, and they needed to have new members. After 20 years, their pastor retired, and a young woman, the congregation actually hired a young woman who was Swedish in her background to come to be their pastor. But she saw that they hadn't updated in 20 years. A lot of movement had happened, one of them being that the language of their church service should include God, who is mother as well as father. There should be some inclusion of this male and female. So she had a baptism coming up and talked to the parents and worked it out, and so she baptized the baby in God, who is both mother and father. The next month, the parish council tried to fire her after that one phrase. She had to fight, and it went on for a year and a half. The bishop had to get involved, and eventually she won. Or maybe truth won, maybe how you could see it. And because of that, she said there is something really missing in Christian education and in Christian understanding of this conception of God. And she said, you know, since 99.9% of all Christian churches in the United States only use male language and male imagery, my church will only use female images. And we will use every name that we can find in the Bible on how to call this God, how to describe this God, and how to be this God. With this, she was attracting a very new, very San Francisco population. The term LGBT might be familiar to you. And they had transgendered members, as well as those that had different sexualities than what is traditionally assumed as heterosexuality. And it turned out that Sophia has been very powerful for this group to identify, especially a female Sophia who incarnates as a male Jesus. Really interesting. And so these three cases that I just shared with you in scholarly studies might kind of reflect the three movements we've seen of gender theory and how it kind of has come to be written about and understood. And you may fall, who knows, within any of this or none of this. Many, use gender as maybe a lower platform that then moves into the transcendence beyond all that has no gender. There's so many ways to understand this. I don't come with really any answers, except to share some of the observations that I've had. So afterwards, if you'd like to know more about that, I'm more than happy to talk about it, but I'd like to shift now. I very much want to thank Aurelio and the Music Research Center for donating this beautiful harp. And so I'd like us to maybe relax again and for you to close your eyes and to reflect on maybe when this type of an experience has happened to you. Thank you. So just settle into your bodies. And with no real direction, I'm just going to ask you some questions. Have you had an encounter with something that you might describe as feminine divine? Ask. For some of you, you may have had many experiences. Certainly with Orville and the Mother, there is much of this energy here. Now ask yourself, is there one particular time that was particularly transformational for you? Now look at that time. What was happening for you when this experience happened? Did it come as it did for me with a voice? Or maybe it just came with an impression? For many, it comes with a deep feeling, a softness. For others, it comes in imagery, in nature, in female form, in something relatable, in something very close. Now in this experience, did you find yourself having an insight? Possibly taking on courage, getting clarity, or maybe it was consolation. Maybe it was more something in your body. Maybe it was more something to say it's all right. And so from that place, ask yourself, what was significant that this experience is considered feminine by you? What does this mean? What did it offer you in your life that maybe you had been seeking and not finding? What did she bring to your heart? And when you feel comfortable, you can stay. You can slowly open your eyes and come back to the room. Well, it is only because of time. It feels so just gentle right now. I would like just to invite whoever might like to share. You don't have to, but if there is anyone who would like to just share something that might have happened to them, I think we're in a space where we would like to hear it.
You've really given us the experience of the embrace that you spoke about.
Hmm.
And there could be many, many kinds of responses that add to the quality and content of that embrace. That's how it strikes me. Because if the embrace is universal, its content has to be many-faceted.
Thank you. And if you could share your name.
Yes, I am Dominique.
Yes.
And when you spoke about connecting with an experience of, it just came to my mind a memory that I had when I did a lot of transformational work on myself. And in short, the experience was discovering in my own body that there was a temple, that my own body and my wound was actually a temple, a sacred place where a divine something was transforming and coming. So just to resonate with what you said, I would like to ask you still, I haven't heard from what you said, the connection that you made with the body aspect, because in our experience, the mother has shown how much this inner travel and experience is connected with the body, and in the darkest place of ourselves, the divine consciousness is residing. So, would you say something about that?
I'd be happy to do that. Well, I think you were very appropriate, Dominique, to point out that in Christian settings, they don't engage the body that much. Let me just be honest. Let's just say. And in fact, even sexuality and those issues. I think the last group I spoke about, they are they do a lot of dance. They actually do their prayers, Our Father as an Our Mother prayer, and they have movement that they do with it. They invoke the grandmothers at the beginning in the four directions in the beginning of their services. And they actually physically have the elder women of the community, and they're actually referred to as the grandmothers of the community. So there's embodiment in people, and there's embodiment in their ritual. There are other experiences that some have been shared with me about what they went through that was very, I can just tell you that it was very much in their bodies where they felt it. But the question of the womb is really powerful. And at the California Institute of Integral Studies, the Women's Spirituality Program does a lot with rites of passage around womb. And in the West, it seems when we think about the words, at least that get used in America, like the curse of that time of the month, like somehow moving one off from what's real, which is the creative force. And I would say that I've seen more embodiment from what you're speaking of, more with the goddess movements in the United States. And I can tell you that in terms of practice, even if a person presents themselves as a Christian, oftentimes they have books on many other religions at home. They attend workshops. They come to Sedona, where I used to live. And we are no longer singly, much smaller and smaller are people there singly identified with one. Some have actually described it as their public religion, their public church, and their private church, or their private practice. And more are just moving into practice and not engaging in church, but my research was with that.
Okay, my name is Hans. And, I had one very special moment, very special. I was starting to get, my English is not so good, sorry, I try. I was starting to get interested in Sri Aurobindo and Mother in this yoga in the 60s, I think, of the last century. And when Mother died in 73, it became serious. I had a feeling, now I must do it. And so it became very serious, so I became very depressed. I became very depressed for many years. There were very large periods of very strong depressive things. But I still could not forget it, of course. I was very much in it, more and more in it. And I went coming here, and I came again. But still, it was a struggle. It was very much a struggle. And one of the journeys, I don't know exactly when it was, in 81, 82, I don't know anymore. I was more depressed than ever, and I was in Delhi. I was there in the Sri Aurobindo ashram, and but I had to come to Pondy and Orville because I had those packages I had to give to this one and that one. So I said, my God, I have to go there. I only want to go home. I don't. So I went to Orville with the packages. I thought, let me drop them as soon as possible. So I went on my bicycle one day, just with the thinking, let me drop the things and go back as soon as. So I came from one of the Madras roads, I think, which is now the highway. And there's on the corner is a little Ganesha temple. And I was very tired. I didn't know it was a Ganesha temple. I mean, it was just a place. I put my bicycle and I stopped there and I was sitting there. And I went into the garden again, sitting there and depressed. And all of a sudden, there was a woman, just an Indian woman, an Amma, or I don't know who she was. And she was looking at me, and she started to pick flowers. And I thought, oh, she's picking flowers. Why is she doing that? Anyway, but she came to me. And she gave that whole bunch of flowers to me. And she had such a big smile. And, well, it was nothing but smile. And... well, that moment, you know, I mean, I don't know what happened, but anyway, the whole thing tumbled completely. And, well, you do not realize what happens. I mean, it just happens. And I was going to my bicycle again and still mentally thinking, let me drop the packages. But I felt different completely, you know. I thought, what am I doing? I just like it here. It's beautiful here. And so it was like my eyes opened and... Mm. And it has never come back. This is always, you know, well. So this was very...
beautiful.
So, and it was a woman, and it was flowers, and it was, well, it was, yeah. For me, it was just perfect.
Hans, okay. Thank you. And yeah? I think what you're pointing, something that you said that I think is very powerful, is that, and maybe a reason why a lot of women like divine feminine work is... The body is seen, and you had an experience of the female body as the symbol that called this forward out of you. And I really do think that, I don't know that all people need this, and I certainly don't know that we need it always, but maybe. But I noticed that there are some people in their development that actually waking up to this, seeing this, embracing this, feeling the womb that Dominique mentioned. These kind of places in ourselves that have been a little numb, like you said, Hans, get made alive. And somehow this femaleness seems to be a great... it just comes with it. Now, I'm sure that there's other symbols too, but... I think for what I see is if women live in societies where they're being told because of the body that they can only do certain things or they're being constrained or socialized certain ways, and then they're being told to love this God that never reflects possibly one of the greatest ways that they've been that they've had to live their life, and yet they're being told that, oh, God loves all of God's children. But you never get to see it. For these Christian women, most Christian women, if they read the Bible, they can never imagine themselves as Jesus. They're always the woman who, Mary Magdalene or Mother Mary or one of the women in the crowd that has a problem and gets healed or, you know, it's like one of those. And the stories don't offer that. So actually, somebody asked me leading up to this talk, would I be speaking about Mother Mary and Mary Magdalene? And I think what's happened is that even in traditions that don't have this balance of story, the way that a lot of Hindu texts do, and certainly the Aurobindo mother texts do, I think just the need of the people brings it forward. So you see Mary, mother of Jesus, being lifted up and celebrated in a much more deified way. And more recently, Mary Magdalene being brought forward as the apostle to the apostles. She was the first to see the empty tomb. That's what the Bible says. And somehow she doesn't get to be acknowledged as one of the core people. And that's been slowly being changed. So yes, the image. And then, Hans, what I find so beautiful is that when we really can behold another, male, female, whatever, and then have in the other present to us divinity, which is what she said, and something so simple and so beautiful, then when you were saying earlier, Dominique, about the grounding and embodiment, that's a place where it happens. Yeah. Thank you.
You know, this is just what comes very much to the forefront for us sitting here in Norwin. You know, at a time when the world is so focused on the fact of an evolving human race. That's no longer something in doubt. That there are major changes of mutation taking place in the human species. And the sense of embodiment is very much there in all our sharing of experiences and discussions. That what does it mean for humanity to have a physical body on earth in which the process of evolution of consciousness and of course of embodiment is taking place. Mm-hmm. These are questions which are going around everywhere. I remember something, a line of Sri Aurobindo's, which remains with me very strongly. He said to the mother a long, long time back that he was referring to transformation of matter and the possibility of that transformation, which means the human body is the first bit of matter that we're in touch with, isn't it? The embodiment factor. And he said, it's only the woman that can build a bridge between the past and the future, between the old world and the new world. And to this, the mother added that it was after quite a while that she began to see what this meant. In fact, this is... this has moved me so much since I came across it about 5-6 years back. That is up there on that board, you know, right at the back behind the tea counter. So we are talking of the feminine not only in terms of consciousness, but in terms of the embodiment of that consciousness on earth. And in our the context of our Orville experience and life, this is such a reality. So it would be nice to hear something from you on this subject.
Absolutely. What's interesting is Christianity, interestingly, is very incarnational. It's very embodied. They call these Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, come one after another, saying they are the fulfillment of the one before, and they all trace their father to Abraham. So in the Abrahamic faiths, the both Islam and Judaism say God is very different than all of creatures in creation. And because of that, the human being is in the creatures, and can't possibly imagine God, just can't. Actually, it's considered blasphemy. So if you walk into a synagogue or you walk into a mosque, you won't see any pictured representation. It will all be symbolic. That's the calligraphy that you see in a lot of the mosques and things, and that's why. But Christianity makes a pretty bold claim that actually God takes human form. That's highly incarnational. I've wondered why it was that it was a lot of this movement has been in Christianity in ways that I didn't see in Islam and Judaism, the two religions that share a common heritage. And I've come to believe that it's really about the embodiment piece of what Christians believe. And what that means is when they walk into a worship space, they're looking at a lot of bodies, mostly male bodies. And for the older forms of Christianity, like the Orthodox and the Roman Catholic, they actually even see a body, a male body on a cross. So I think that's why for females and for men looking for more balance, having to picture that becomes really essential, because it's an incarnation, the God who comes fully human, all at the same time, not separated, not half and half, fully all at the same time. And when it's in the male body only, it almost makes that, makes the missing point even stronger. I think you also, in Christian terms, then, because this permission to make God looking like a male body, then the Godhead, God the Father is usually shown as a white guy with a long beard on a throne. Jesus is kind of 30-ish. And then the Holy Spirit often is shown as a dove. But that's another way that a lot of Christian groups, they actually refer to that part as the female part, the Holy Spirit that's moving. But interesting, if they put the image of a female body in the worship space as God, it usually creates a bit of a ruckus. And hopefully, maybe, with little gatherings like this and a little bit of information sharing, and certainly an appreciation of the East and what it knows for the West and how the West is reaching to find more balance, we can all contribute to this. So I will stay here if you have any personal questions. I'm finding that I really appreciated all the conversations. Many of you that are here, I've had some already extended deep conversations over the course of the week. And I hope that what I've shared might give you a couple thoughts to reflect on some of the experiences you've had. And I would love to stay in touch with anybody who would like that. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.